Welcome. This panel comes from a blog post I wrote following the sacrament meeting.
We're getting started. Would you all take your seats, please?
Actually, I'm used to being ignored. In fact, the high priest group would make an effort to let people sleep if they need to. At least I do when I'm teaching. Anyway, this panel comes from a blog post I wrote following the sacrament meeting. The speaker told a story about a young man who eventually stood up against his friends on behalf of a disabled schoolmate. That made me think of my oldest living child. She did the same thing. She stood up to her social group when they decided to torment a disabled schoolmate. Unlike the boy in the story, her friends did not come around. They threw her out of the group and hounded her mercilessly. Do I need to speak louder?
Yes.
Thank you. One of my problems, I try not to speak too loud. And there are a number of reasons for that, but if I'm too quiet for you, let me know. For a young girl in a new town, just 2 years after the latest death of a sibling had left her an only child, it was devastating to lose all of her friends. Luckily, she had not heard the story I heard in sacrament meeting, so that she did not feel betrayed by God as well when her friends did not come around. There are many stories we tell. Often, they are true. Sometimes, they are fables. I would suggest that the stories we tell about virtue always being immediately rewarded, about how doing the right thing is a painless task, and about always being rescued. These stories may fail us, and may fail those we tell them to. They may fail our children, and they fail those we care for when they face adversity. In my own life, I did the right thing and lost my dream job by raising a conflict of interest issue. It hurt to have the job offer withdrawn. At the time, I remembered an Old Testament story where three men about to be thrown to their deaths made the point of saying that they had done right. If God allowed them to die, as they expected, they wanted others to take their deaths not as a sign that they had been failed by God and not as a sign their faith was in vain. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were delivered, but they knew that not being miraculously saved did not mean that God had failed them or their faith was false. The stories we tend to tell now send the opposite message, that if it all does not work out, our faith is false. So what happened to my daughter when 7 years later, a group of boys prepped a chair against the door when the teacher stepped out? They intended to beat up the shy, bookish Jewish kid in the class. My withdrawn, quiet child stood up and berated them until they backed down. She had no expectation of anything happening except that she would be beaten up with him. She had not known the boy, but she knew what was right and that it was wrong to stay quiet. She was ready to pay a real price. I meet too many people who are only willing to pay no price at all. I think we betray our listeners by sharing stories of easy virtue and quick rewards. We cheat them with an implicit promise that we will have no negative side effects, no negative outcomes. We do not prepare them to make real sacrifices. I'm grateful to be on this panel with Teresa Edwards, Tracy McKay, Janet Gerard Willis, and Catherine Sofer. And I had to read those names in that order because we've changed the order in which they're going to speak. I just gave it to you in that order. Each of them will tell you their own story, which forms the best possible introduction for each person and each experience. Then I will share my personal story. Then we will all invite you to comment, ask questions, and to share your stories with us. Thank you. And I'll now turn this over to Teresa.
Thanks, Stephen. Really pleased by the people we have to speak with us today. This is a pretty special group of people, and I think when I was describing us to Stephen, I described us as being a a grand collection of catastrophe. Because I think between us, there's probably not a challenge you could name that one of us hasn't been through. So in our house, we joke that we don't get showered with blessings, we get crushed by them. Our blessings often come in a crunchy hardship coating. We sacrifice for an anniversary vacation, and Hurricane Charlie meets us there. We're finally able to buy a house, so we had to move away from everyone we loved to do it. My husband got a well-paying job, but it came with a totally toxic corporate environment. After 8 years of infertility, we finally got our miracle child, only to have him born 3 months premature, resulting in cerebral palsy. I have a very dark sense of humor now, and I'm tempted to say that God does too. When I first read the blog post that Stephen wrote about the stories we tell to each other, it rang a bell in me. I just chafe against those happy enzyme endings, with what Stephen describes as lessons of easy virtue, because they have no reflection in my own reality. I am and have always been a very good girl. I've never done drugs, never sipped alcohol. My first kiss was in college to the man I eventually married. And yet, my life is ridiculous. Seriously, ridiculous. My college roommates nicknamed me CK for conversation killer. Because we'd be all telling stories about our goofy teenage hijinks. And I bust out with, that reminds me of the time when I was at EFY and my mom called me to tell me that she was having her friend remove all the guns out of the house because she saw them right to my father. And then, you know, you hear crickets chirping. Thank you. I think it's hilarious too. I would just roll over laughing at the absurdity of the situation, and everyone else would just look at me with horror, like, poor little thing. The lessons of my own life have taught me that there is no one-to-one correlation between a happy life full of blessings and adherence to any type of commandments. And yet we succeed in teaching each other the very opposite of that. So much so that despite every other trial I have been through in my life, and there were doozies, on the day that my son was diagnosed with cerebral palsy and my husband lost his job, the very same day, mind you, the first thought that went through my head was, if I had been reading my scriptures more, I would not be punished like this. Intellectually, we can all recognize that as total garbage, but tell me in your darkest moments if that thought has not occurred to you, and I will call you a liar. Part of this is, of course, human nature. We live in a chaotic and confusing world, so to be able to sleep at night, we tell ourselves that there is something we can do to avoid calamity. But then we as Mormons take that human nature and compound it by teaching it to each other through the public face we show to the world and even in our lesson manuals. I've been teaching in Young Women's for the past 7 years and counting, and I like to tell this story to my young women. My husband Jared has three great loves in his life: me, his son, and football. He was a great big star all throughout high school. He played All-State in California, which is a massive, massive deal. He was recruited for college. He chose BYU, and then he went on his mission. And his mission president was a total BYU booster. And so when he found out that Jared was to be released a few months after he would have needed to show up for spring ball, he said, well, we can send you home early if you'd like, so you can attend training camp. And Jared, in this missionary zeal, he decides, well, I need to take this to the Lord before I make a decision. So in prayer, and he reads his patriarchal blessing, and there's specific language that said that refers to a full 2 years he will serve. And so he takes that as significant and decides to turn down the mission president's offer, serve the entire 2 years of his mission, and then go home and address football. And so at this part of the story, I often stop and I ask my young women, so what do you guys think happened? And raised on a steady diet of enzyme endings and new era stories, they say, he went and he played football better than ever. And I say, no, he never played football again. And I may take a little twisted pleasure in bursting that bubble, but I believe firmly that I am doing them a service. These girls have been raised on the new era and these young women lesson manuals that teach over and over again that sacrificing is immediately rewarded with what you wanted or something better. After I break their hearts with my story, I'll go on to discuss being a true disciple of Christ and how that means giving up everything we have, even our desires for ourselves, in order to follow him, and how that is the reward. How when we keep the commandments, what we are promised is a companionship of the Holy Ghost and eternal life in the world to come, and that is it. And any claims to financial rewards, large families, good jobs, health, those are solely at the discretion of the Lord, and we have very little to do with it. When we tell each other those stories of easy virtue, the stories that say that being good will bring us immediate earthly rewards, we set each other up for failure. We set each other up for heartbreak, disappointment, and betrayal. We create small minds and small hearts who look on the trials of others as condemnation. We send these girls out into a world, arming them only with their trust in a God who rewards them for seminary attendance, and then avert our eyes when sooner or later a God who is actually interested in our personal development allows hardships into our lives that we have been ill prepared for. Then we all get older and go to Relief Society, and every single person there feels like they don't fit the mold of the perfect model Mormon woman in some way, whether it's through divorce, no children, disabled children, mental illness, personal failings, bad family relationships, financial struggles, blah, 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 blah. Instead of creating Zion, we're creating a room full of outcasts convinced they are not fit for the kingdom. Even before I started blogging, I couldn't help but tell the unvarnished truth of my life. I just don't really have very many personal boundaries. And once I left the family I grew up with, I never again wanted to spend that amount of energy keeping up appearances. Despite my youthful missteps and oversharing that earned me the nickname CK, I have found that being open about the realities of my life has consistently been rewarding and empowering. I have had so many women thank me for what is no more remarkable than just being myself, but it allowed other people to do the same. I've been able to reach out and serve so many women struggling with abusive childhoods, infertility, disabled children, by doing no more than just raising my hand and saying, me too. And I have had women I never would have expected come to my aid because I was willing to ask for help. When you grow up in an abusive household, you internalize shame. You become convinced that there is something wrong about you that makes you earn this behavior. And you typically take one of two paths. You accept that you are so bad that you can't be redeemed, and you set out down a road of destruction, or you work with all of your energy to hide your badness from the rest of the world. For most of my life, I worked to hide it. I rarely had friends over, made excuses for my parents, and worked my little heart out to excel in every way. But at 16, I left home and began a long process of recovery, and at 18, I went off to BYU, where any shame I might have felt compared to my secular friends was exacerbated and crushing. Back then, I started opening up because I liked the shock value. I liked feeling like a badass without having to do anything with consequences. I fell in love with the thought of myself as this worldly, tortured soul, and I totally played the part. But then in one of the last Fast and Testimony meetings of the year, one of my friends from the ward, this return missionary, successful in school, this beautiful, holy woman, she bore her testimony and confessed to being abused as a child. And she discussed how that had shaped her spiritual journey. You could have just knocked me over with this feather, but this woman I admired so much shared this history with me, this history that I was convinced came out of my own evilness. I went up to her afterwards, and we just held hands together like Anne of Green Gables and Diana Barry. And I told her how much hope she had given me, and she told me how just by having a big mouth, I had paved the way for her to be honest. Like most hard lessons in life, I had to learn this one a few times. Years later, I was newly married and living in a ward in Costa Mesa, California. There was a woman in that ward who had AIDS. And I assumed that if that information became public knowledge, that she would be completely ostracized. And I cringed at how open the woman was about her condition. She just seemed to trust everyone with this information. In the middle of weekly announcements, our Relief Society president mentioned that this woman was out of the hospital and could use some help. So someone asked, what was the problem? What should she go to the hospital for? And the woman, the Relief Society president, she just goes, she had an infection, and since she has AIDS, it was fairly serious. And I think I might have just said that, and I was going, how do you say that? In my own small-mindedness, I expected these women to recoil at the knowledge and the implication that this disease might have for this woman's life. And instead, it could not have been treated more matter-of-factly. It was as if the Relief Society president just said, she has diabetes, and so it was fairly serious. The woman of that ward just rallied around this woman. They took her son in when necessary. They ministered to her in a way that has forever changed me. When you sincerely ask for help, I have found that people are almost always more generous than you think they will be. It was in that same ward that we began our epic battle with infertility. And probably motivated by the examples I had provided for me in that ward, I wanted to start a support group for those of us who were dealing with this. I was like 22, 23. I stood up in Relief Society, and I just kind of fumbled my way through announcements. It's like, a lot of us want kids, and some of us can't, and they're taking my house. And there were about 9 of us that showed up, and our first meeting basically consisted of us just eating that cake that was in my house and passing the tissue box around, and holding hands. But just being together, just acknowledging the fact of our pain, it was united. It was the most pure expression of bearing another's burdens that I had ever experienced in the gospel. And when babies were born to that group of women, oh, how we rejoiced. Those babies were all of our babies. The first step towards being a Zion people is being honest. We cannot be of one heart and one mind if we are hiding what is there. Obviously, I'm not suggesting that we all become those ward martyrs and take up every fast and testimony meeting with the litany of how very hard our life is. But it has been my lifelong endeavor to learn where that line is between appropriate and inappropriate sharing. And I think that the difference, like so many things in life, lies in intent. There's a difference between airing dirty laundry for revenge or telling stories to garner sympathy than just living honestly with the facts of our life. Living honestly allows other people to do the same. It allows other people to recognize God's hand in all of our lives, that God is found in the depths of our trials, not in the outward showing of wealth. Wanting to hide the tragedy in our lives is a very human response, but I'm not sure it's a very celestial one. If we are going to do more than pay lip service to the idea of eternal progression, then we have to respect the role hardships play in our lives and in the lives of each other. What would happen if instead of caving into that lizard brain reaction to distance ourselves from someone in the midst of the trial because we didn't know what to say, and because, let's face it, there's a part of us that's afraid of catching it, what if we, instead of running away, we recognize that that person was in the middle of a holy pilgrimage? What if, instead of feeling shame, we felt privileged? I have a friend who told me that in the course of a Relief Study lesson, the teacher talked about how the worst thing that ever happened to her was how she had this child's bike stolen. And my friend, who has had legions of hardships befall upon her, she just sat there in her seat and thought, that explains a few things. It has become kind of a shorthand between us. You know, whenever somebody does something particularly judgmental or uninformed, we just kind of look at each other and go, bless her heart, she's only had her bike stolen. It is a truth with a capital T that adversity makes us stronger. So why are we so everlastingly ashamed of it? Nothing in my life has afforded me more kindness, more empathy, more wisdom than going through the refinement of hardship. Nothing has brought me closer friendships, truer examples of Christ-like ministry, more tender expressions of friendship than acknowledging the moments that bring me pain. We moved a few months ago, and on our last Sunday in our old ward, this woman I worked with in my calling, she came to me in tears, and I was really surprised by that reaction, because we were friendly, but I didn't think, you know, tears, friends. And she confessed to me her deep feelings of inadequacy, her heartache at how far away she felt from the mark. These feelings overwhelmed her to the point of nearly choking her belief. As we wept together in the middle of the chapel, she told me that she would only attend the meeting if she knew I was going to be teaching, because she knew there would be something in there she could relate to. I am nowhere near delusional enough to think that had anything to do with anything laudable about me, except maybe I can live through a total mess of a life, but simply because I cannot help but inject the messy reality of my life and what I do without being a total fraud, there is no saying that I am just more blessed. My friend Janet likes to say that God is not a vending machine for the righteous. If that was the way life worked, our heavenly parents would not be teaching children. They would be training a pet. We are not Pavlov's dog. We are children of God learning how to be like them. And ultimately, that is the reward in going through life's tragedies, knowing God. We become acquainted with them in our extremities, whether we welcome it or not. Thank you.
I think Tressa just gave most of my talk. I just met her for the first time today, but we're basically the same person. I'm going to open and close with prayer by Khalil Gibran. Even as the stone of the fruit must break that its heart may stand in the sun, so must you know pain. And could you keep your heart in wonder at the daily miracles of your life, your pain would not seem less wondrous than your joy. And seasons, you would accept the seasons of your heart, even as you have always accepted the seasons that pass over your fields. And you would watch with serenity through the winters of your grief. Much of your pain is self-chosen. It is the bitter portion by which the physician within you heals your sick self. Therefore, trust the physician and drink his remedy in silence and tranquility. For his hand, though heavy and hard, is guided by the tender mercy of the unseen. And the cup he brings to your lips, though it may burn, has been fashioned of the clay which the potter has moistened with his own sacred tears. The nexus of my writing happened about 5 years ago when I started my blog. And like Tressa, I have a problem with boundaries, appropriate sharing, inappropriate sharing. And I actually began my blog as a response to something somebody wrote somewhere on the internet which I disagreed with. And I just had to write something. And she wouldn't let me comment on her blog. She had her comments closed. And the only way I could write anything was to get my own URL. And that's how I started writing. Turns out it's actually been an incredibly life-broadening experience to open myself up that way. When I first started writing 5 years ago, I was a new convert to the church. I joined the church as an adult at 29. And I started documenting my experiences. I'm the only member in my family, and I have a lot of people in my family that are very anti-Mormon. And I began to document everything that happened. I began to document my spiritual journey as I learned how to be a member of the church, where to draw the line, where my balancing point was, what these things meant to me personally. and it's okay. So what happened was really organic growth. I started out writing into the darkness, not imagining anybody ever would read anything I wrote. And then as I genuinely and honestly, with very porous boundaries, began to write about my experiences of life, people started to come. People started to come and read and comment and send me emails and write me letters. And I was kind of agog. Wow, people are actually reading this stuff I send out in the middle of the night about my journey, about why somebody like me, who comes from a very liberal California family, chose to join the Mormon Church. And the tension and conflict that brought to my life, and how I was trying to work to resolve it, and why it matters to me, and why I've worked it out to stay. And you know, what started out as 2 or 3 people reading has turned into 30,000 people a month reading. And I think it's because of the genuineness of the story and the willingness of being able to give the non-ensign ending, as Tressa pointed out, that the people that were sitting in, there's a place for the unsigned ending. There's a place for those fables. There's a place for them. I'm kind of getting ahead of myself here, so. But I think that what people were responding to was that they were hearing something that they weren't getting elsewhere. And like Tressa, I don't necessarily attribute that to myself. I think it was just my willingness to be able to tell the story. I'm going to read something, an excerpt that I wrote recently. It's true, I've realized lately in the new paradigm I inhabit with my unwilling and unruly children, I've retreated the tiniest bit back into my nest. Part of this is the divorce and my children's emotional space. How much can I write about where I'm at now without violating their small personal space? I don't have that answer. I haven't figured that out. It doesn't help that the loose ends are not all cut yet and that they are raveling strings blowing in the wind. And as these strings ravel and knot, they create little nests of their own. Despite the divorce being legal and final, is final ever even an equation when you have 3 children? No matter how big the mistakes that were made, all the non-answers float around in my head and steal my sleep. Jeffrey asked me where my wedding ring was today. The small pebbles in your shoe are the ones that trip you up, like the child thinking his parents' marriage fell apart because he lost the cufflinks on the dresser. No, my sweet, it's not ever, no, never, not ever your fault. My wedding ring is shut away with my popped heartstrings in a tiny white leather box lined with red velvet. Crimson on the inside, and when you crack the box, it's like cracking my heart. Can I have it, Mom? Innocence. You already do, son. The others chime in, nervous about the lion's share being commandeered by the firstborn yet again. I want it, Mom, I want it. Mama, can I have your pretty diamond ring, the silver one? It's not silver, I think. I hold the words in my mouth, unhatched like a robin's egg. It's my remnant, my fossil, child. We shall wait and see. You do not yet know what you ask. Something had to give, and it turns out it was housekeeping. For a while, I thought it was taking care of me because I must like my lessons warmed over and reheated for 12 or 15 years. But I was wrong. And I am finding that path again, mercifully close enough that my feet weren't so far. Just get me through, just get me through. My prayers are like a mantra, giving rhythm and cadence to my day. Get me through and leave me alone, because I cannot write a paper on the contrast between Aldous Huxley and Albert Camus while singing the song from the backyard again. I can't do it, I cannot. Please, child, 2 more weeks, just let me finish. Guilt, fear, frustration, and surrender. And so I write things like this, and then I get comments and emails and letters from other women saying, I thought I was the only one. I'm the only divorced woman in my ward. My divorce is fresh, it was final back in February. And so, the feedback and the sense of community, the sense of communion that it engenders in being willing to open yourself. Emotional squeamishness gets us nowhere. These are the stories that need to be told. It's as valid of a story as the ones in the Ensign. And the stories need to be told because as writers, we understand that this is truth, and we hear it in the letters, we hear it in the words. We hear it in the emails and the phone calls and the cards that we get from people states away or countries away in some cases. And life is hard. It hurts. It's full of pain. And the carving pain and heights are determined by the depths of the sorrow that you've experienced. And it's what creates understanding and compassion in you so that you can relate to your fellow brothers and sisters on the same struggle. And so much of our understanding does originate from what was once pain. It results in relationships, building bridges, community, and like I said, communion. I have a theory on why Mormon blogging has become such an enormous juggernaut. Our standard sources of stories before the modern age were not holding up mirrors in which we could really see reflections that showed us who we were. At least that we could maybe recognize our struggles. When you only hear the faith-promoting rumors, you start to wonder, what's wrong with me? Like Tressa said, if I had only read my scriptures more, my husband wouldn't have started taking drugs and my marriage wouldn't have blown apart. What is wrong that causes that type of thought to happen? Like a fable, lessons can be gleaned from the faith-promoting stories. They can. But if your life doesn't work out like an after-school special, wrapped up tidy by the end of the hour, what do you do? What do you do with the person whose real life is a struggle and they feel then desolate and alone because their story didn't compress in that hour? Those faith-promoting stories, I postulate, can actually end up being damaging when a person who applies the gumball theory to their lives, borrowing from Janet, that, you know, put the penny in, faith, get the prize out, the life you want. Doesn't work that way. When Mormon lay writing took off, I think that the veneer, the glossy veneer that we had cultivated of the 1950s idyllic perfect family was kind of blissfully cast off because none of us fit that. We all understand what it is, but none of us fit that. It's this false image that doesn't really exist. we do have writers who do present the shiny, happy, perfect face, but by and large, they're not taken seriously because it's not possible to have an idyllic life all the time. Writers and storytellers who don't acknowledge that lose credibility. I'm going to read another excerpt. A gaping hole of loss and sorrow sits inside of me, soft, a heavy knot, waiting. The flurry of messes, children, study, deadlines, pressures, and chores allows me in spurts to cruise along and ignore the hole. I can even forget about it for periods of time. But when I least expect it or am prepared to deal with it, it rears its head and eviscerates me, leaving a pile of wet ashes in the corner. I'm running, I am afraid. I am afraid I will let myself down. I am afraid the past patterns of neglectful personal behavior are too strong in their gravity and I cannot escape them anymore. Then a star can choose to a new place in the galaxy. God can move mountains, and it shows my gossamer vulnerability that the dark fears cast long fingers of shadow across my faith. I know better, yet it zeroes in with precision on the soft white underbelly of my soul. So I keep running, I have to. The only difference is now I think I am beginning to understand. I am beginning to notice, as I notice outside the flurry of pain for brief moments, what I have always done in the past no longer serves me. I must, once again, dig deep and take a long, honest look at my life. It's like trying to stand on a ball. You have only the barest glimmer of a moment of perfect balance. And before you are once again thrown off, using all your might to try to find that place of perfect stillness again. Only memory guides the yearn for balance, and memory is a tricky thing. My mind is an insatiable black hole, so severe in its gravity, it devours anything that comes near, an emitting seemingly unending fountain of invisible radiation black back into space. You can't see it, but it needs to devour and overtake everything. Only recently have I realized this, and with the realization came the notion that maybe, just maybe, the mind doesn't rule the world. Maybe there's a wisdom in the body and the heart as well. Wisdom that is overshadowed by the unending noise generated from above. My head wants to be entertained, but my heart is still and quiet. My mouth wants a party, but my belly is full and needs nothing. My eyes want to drive, but my arms and legs are the vehicle. It's deceptive and frightening how the intellectual noise completely shuts out the wisdom of the body. I've got some work to do, and I've got some knots to unravel, and some radiation to redirect. These are the kind of posts that I get the most feedback from readers. These are the posts that I get, the emails, the letters, the cards. Mostly women, because that's mostly who reads my writing, but of people who aren't seeing a mirror held up that they can recognize themselves in. And I think this is why I'm willing to allow those boundaries to keep being porous, and partly because I don't know how to be any other way. So I want to close with another poem by Khalil Gibran. Your joy is your sorrow unmasked, and the self-same well from which your laughter rises is oftentimes filled with your tears. How else can it be? The deeper the sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can ultimately contain. Is not the cup that holds your wine the very cup that was burnt in the potter's oven? And is not the lute that soothes your spirit the very wood that was hollowed with knives? When you are joyous, take a deep look at your heart, and you shall find only that which has given you sorrow is also giving you joy. When you are sorrowful, look again at your heart, and you shall see that the truth you are weeping for is that which has been your delight. Some say joy is greater than sorrow, and others say, nay, sorrow is greater. But I say unto you, they are inseparable. Together they come, and when one sits alone at your board, remember that the other is asleep in your bed. Verily, you are suspended like scales between your sorrow and joy, and only when you are empty are you at a standstill and balanced. When the treasure keeper lifts you to weigh his gold and his silver, needs must your joy or your sorrow rise or fall. Thank you.
So then there's a very sad story about the third-hand computer that the shortly before giving a talk completely erases it. I actually usually don't write out conference addresses. Is it that better? Ah, yay. I don't usually write out my conference addresses, and because of a recent health issue, I'm having memory things. So I wrote out this one, and then my computer is having memory issues, and it erased the whole thing an hour ago. So I have two little pieces of paper from the hotel. We'll see how this goes. But one of the things I meant to say was that often tragedies are, if you look at them in the right light, vaguely funny. So, yes, vaguely funny. My computer is vaguely funny. I remember when I came home from my mission, it was not the homecoming I had envisioned. I envisioned balloons at the airport, and instead it was my parents frantically running down the hallway of the Seattle airport because my mission president had forgotten to call them to tell them that I was coming home early, very ill. He was a very busy man, I suppose. You think he might have thought to tell them, however, that their daughter was quite ill and coming home at least a year early. So I called them on my layover just to make sure they had the right flight, and they said, "What? You're doing what?" And there weren't balloons, there were panicked parents. But in the few days that followed, I was quite angry, and I read a lot of scriptures and cried a lot and yelled a lot and yelled at God a lot. And there were two stories that struck me a lot in my scriptures. Stories central to my identity, our identity as Christians. The first is just a tiny, tiny bit of the story. It's just the words, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," as Christ is hanging on the cross. The unexpected moment in the expectedness of his journey as a Savior, the unexpected moment of abandonment. And I related so heavily to that. And it is that moment of abandonment that makes his empathy possible in our moments of abandonment. That tiny moment in his journey that makes it possible, entirely possible, for him to be my Savior, even when I'm alone. The other story that struck me so, so hard and continues to be what I come back to again and again and again as a Christian is when he visits the people in the Book of Mormon. And, you know, they've had this tremendous cacophony, darkness, and then suddenly the sky is pierced by light, and this being comes out of the sky, and he's speaking to them. And you'd think, you know, that would be enough for them to think this is a magnificent deity, but that's not what Christ uses to prove his identity. He holds out his hands, the perfect body of a god, the resurrected, perfected body of a god, and he shows them scars, the proof of violence done to his body. His perfect body, completely perfect now, marks of pain. And that is what he reaches out to his children with and holds out to them to prove to him that he is a god. And that's what they touch. And that is when they come to him and embrace him. His scars. And they remain on his perfect body. That image has become very central to my identity as a Christian and to my mission as a Christian. I believe that if I am to act as Christ acts, that I am not to erase my scars, that they are to remain visible, and that I am to use them when I reach out to other people, that they are to be forefront, center. When I reach out my hand to other people, that I can say, here I am. They might be healed a little bit, but I'll use them to help you if I can. And that is what I try to do a little bit when I write, although hopefully not didactically. I don't think that we should try to be didactic. There's a place for didactic writing. There's a place for what we call home literature in the Mormon literary tradition. I think that sometimes home writing gets too much of a bad reputation. If you think about writers such as Jack Hoyland, he was the first Mormon writer to address the subject of sexual violence, really, in popular Mormon literature. He was banned from Deseret Book all over the country. So credit where credit is due. Some of that safe literature hasn't always been so safe, and I think we need to give some of that supposedly patents or writing a little bit more credit. Sometimes, even though they're wrapped up tidily with a bow at the end, the content in the middle has been a little messier than we might recognize. Tara Tempest Williams, in her short story, Undressing the Bear, says, "We are healed by our stories. Yesterday, I heard Phyllis Barber say, the world needs stories. The world needs compassion. The world needs us to understand one another." She talked further about how there's a little place in our souls that is shaped perfectly for a story to fit into. It's not shaped like a sermon. It's not even shaped like a song. It's shaped just perfectly for a story. In every culture, you have the creation myth that's a story. We don't exactly know why that is, but in every culture, there's room for stories. Children want bedtime stories. We need the stories of people's lives. When we write, and when people read, they vicariously place themselves into the writer's place. We ask them to see and experience our world. What world are we asking them to consider? How will we share that space with them? It's an invitation. I can't remember which philosopher it was that said, reading is the most intimate act, not sex, because you never spend that long in that proximity with the mind of another human being. I believe that might be true, and that is why honesty is so important, because we are asking someone to be us when they read our writing. Everybody kind of already talked about my vending machine metaphor. I was going to talk about that. I do like that. I think one of the reasons that it's dangerous, and I do think there is a place for the little section in the enzyme with the little inspirational stories, and I have noticed that occasionally a story creeps in that doesn't end tidily. It ends with a, "I'm not sure why this happened. But look, I've continued on with my faith, and I learned to press on, and I'm kind of impressed that the enzyme started to do that." I told my brother-in-law about this panel, and he said, wouldn't it be cool if right after that section in the enzyme, they then had a section where it was, "And then my life fell to crap, but look at me, I got up and dusted off my butt and pressed on." But every once in a while, that section does kind of have a story like that, which impresses me. But what I think is dangerous about those vending machine stories, it's not that it never happens. Sometimes I pray for God to tell me where my car keys are, and lo and behold, God tells me where my car keys are. And I have friends who have desperately wanted a baby, and I've prayed for a baby, and they've gotten a baby. And I desperately wanted a baby, and God gave me a baby. It wasn't through my womb, but my adoption stories, Teresa knows the story, I think it is miraculous as anybody who conceived triplets after prayer and fasting. I'll defend it, it's just as big of a miracle. Amen. I think more that it's the sort of theology that the story can develop in your mind. It's the relationship with God that story sort of invites you to have, where God is at your beck and call, and righteousness is not for righteousness' sake, where righteousness is because you want a pony, and God is Santa Claus. And it's not so much that we don't want God to bless us. Of course, we want blessings, but that is the danger I see in that type of story. It's not that those things never happen. It's that it invites us to look at ourselves as small, small children and God as a parent who doesn't parent very well, who rewards us for being quiet in the supermarket with sugar. I think that complicated literature, you know, as an accompaniment to the occasional bit of simple anecdote, complicated literature, honest stories that tell about lives complexly lived with complexity, those encourage a theology of moral reasoning where righteousness is the reward for righteousness. A righteous life is a reward for a righteous life. And that should be enough. At least I think it should be enough. Although certainly I'm glad to get my ponies when they come. Although they might often be covered in what ponies produce. Otherwise I wouldn't be honest now. I also joked with my brother-in-law when I told him about this panel. I said, so I wonder if they were just going down the list. Let's see, who can we come up with that has had a lovely list of crappy things happen to them?
Janet.
But I do believe that the sort of stories that encourage theology as moral reasoning offer more comfort, because everybody does need company in their dark nights of the soul when they feel all alone. Everyone needs preparation. That's why Christ had that Eli, lama sabachthani moment, because he needed empathy in all things in order to be our Savior. That's the one thing he wasn't prepared for. If he'd been prepared for it, it wouldn't have really worked. By reading, by placing themselves vicariously in the position of those of us who've suffered before, people are prepared and might not feel so alone. They have the Anne of Green Gables bit, even if metaphorically, a hand to hold. We actually have a canonical foundation for that in our scriptures, really, if you think about it. The Psalm of Nephi, it's beautiful, but it's still a bit of whining. It's gorgeous whining nonetheless. Alma's lament, Joseph at Liberty Jail, such despair. And you can think that those are tied up tidily at the end, but they were still living in the moment when they were writing them. If you believe it's historical, the story of Job, even if it's not historical, it's still a lovely, story of suffering. Hannah grieving about her infertility and being mistaken for a drunk. I mean, someone who's gone through that. Insult. And you can tie those up tidily in the Sunday school room, as we often hear done on Sundays, but if you think about them honestly, they're not, in moments lived, tidy. You can't clean up the blood on the brick path beneath Carthage, the children left orphaned, the woman grieving with her empty womb in the moment that it's empty, worms crawling of the wife left in the dirt. She can't really be replaced by the new wife. And you have to live those moments when they're there. That is a canonical foundation that we have if we're willing to accept it as one and talk honestly with one another in the gospel doctrine classes about that, and then link it to our lives, as we are so often invited to do in gospel doctrine. How does this apply to our lives? Have we experienced something like this? Well, what do you know? We can honestly share when we have. Our abstract for this session said, well, what have we written about? So what have I written about? First thing I published in my life, I think, was about being sexually assaulted both as a young child and as an adult. And the Dean of Honors Education at the time, who's my good friend, I still believe he is my good friend, he sat me down and said, Janet, honey, don't publish this. You will be pigeonholed forever as a sexual assault victim feminist. Always, you will be seen as the feminist. You know what? Yep. That's okay. And I write for feminists. Well, I'm starting to write again for Feminist Mormon Housewives. Where I've written about infertility, and I have written extensively. Teresa nicely says that I've endlessly educated people in the comments about sexual assault. I've written about chronic illness. Most recently, I lost 5 months of my life. I have huge gaping holes of almost dying last winter, watching my son watch his mother almost die. Watching a three-year-old struggle with that. That's not something I've written about yet, and I don't know when I will, but someday I will. I lost a daughter, sort of a stillbirth, if you will,
we agreed to adopt her right when her mother peed on a stick, and then she changed her mind when she was born. And that was hard. I wrote about that. This is up on my red button. Am I doing okay?
You're fine.
Okay. So I wanted to share one thing I wrote. This is a poem I wrote for FMH, and I only ever wrote one draft. It was what I wrote basically the day we found out. It's called Goodbye, Sadie Jane. No documents record your name, none will. Not at your birth, your never blessing, or your death. In the annals of this life, you simply never were. Never were my Sadie Jane, my anything at all. I chose the gravitas of biblical appellation and turned it inside out with diminutive affection. Sarah, changed to Western style for red-brown curls, sunspots on a face with sunny disposition, or maybe long and blonde and tame dimples. The rhyming Jane, a quirky pull on the corners of the mouth where simple, softened lines don't meet, or one eyebrow rises higher than the other when you smother laughter to the hand I'll never clasp. No arms will ever hold you with the name I chose, and mine will never hold you with another. The folded clothes tuck into neat and downy squares sent to other babies, other arms, other mothers elsewhere. Tidy blankets lie inside a chest upstairs, creases left intact at the dismantled hopes inside of mine. Adam called the animals, and in so doing called himself to separation. I am Adam reversed, the Eve who is not mother of all living. For someone else will call you forth, and in so doing call you theirs, but you were mine. You were mine in dreaming, in the pages between Celine and Samantha, in the closet spaces where toddler blue made room for Pintuck's white on gentle pink, in the multiplication from two cells into two legs, two arms, too many hopes, and my Edenic promise, which started and then kept your small heart beating for an 8-month space of vanity which functions vain only for me. In that space now gone, you were here, and you were mine. I published that on the blog, and I was greatly comforted. I found great solace in the number of people who commented. But what I found the greatest solace in was the one comment that came months later from one woman who had an adoption fall through, who hadn't been able to find anything on failed adoption on the internet to comfort her. And she sent me, she posted a little comment and then sent me a little note just thanking me for the poem. She found clinical things, you know, percentages of failed adoptions, 80%, very grim. But nothing to deal with what it feels like. Because nobody will acknowledge that it feels like having a baby die. And that's why I'm glad I published that poem. Not just because writing is how I enter the world, but because it reached out to someone and touched her in her moment of need. Very recently, I've been corresponding with the man I babysat for a million years ago when I was a teenager. I never would have pegged him for an FMH reader. My gosh, he wore button-up shirts when he was 25, ties every day. And he's an FMH reader, I guess. He found me, he figured out I was his former babysitter from when I was 16. And he deduced somehow that I was some sort of expert on the sexual abuse in Mormonism and a survivor of that. And he'd had a massive tragedy happen in his family. And he needed statistics, and he needed clinical help, and he needed someone to talk to that he trusted. And we've been corresponding for a few months now, and now just another huge blow up in his family just this week. But just little things. He had a nephew serve time in prison for raping his niece. And he's so angry at this nephew. And I pointed out that a child who commits rape at the age of 14 is probably himself a survivor of some sort of violence. And none of his extended family, it had never occurred to this huge extended Mormon family, never occurred to a single one of them that the perpetrator might also be a victim.
and just, okay, I've written a lot about what happened to me, but the fact that I can share one fact and then also what it's like to survive and find joy and not, I don't find a lot of pain in my experience anymore. But to help him see his nephew as something other than a monster and find hope for both his nephew and his niece and the whole huge family, to me that means the world. To hold out my hand with its scars and hold the hand of another, even if it's just through cyberspace. That's why I write what I write. And I hope I can be honest in doing it. Wendell Berry said we... What did Wendell Berry say? Gosh, now I'm over-emotional. We love where we cannot trust, and we trust where we cannot know. I think that that's true. We have to love where we cannot trust, and trust where we cannot know. That's what you do when you write on the internet. And that's what you do when you offer your writings out into an audience you can't see. That's what you do when you share the tragedies of your life. And I think it's worth it if you can touch one soul. Or even if you can mend your own soul. So that's why I write. Thank you.
Kind of a daunting prospect to be the one speaking for the 15 minutes before dinner. and also after you've already listened to three such intelligent and astute women speak, saying so many of the things that I would say myself. I wanted to address this topic with the purpose of speaking to those who have considered writing, but aren't sure whether this is a path for them. Not writing in general, but this kind of writing. Those who have been listening and realizing that they have stories to share, but aren't quite sure that they can bring themselves to share them. I really appreciate Trace's remarks about the importance of honesty in building Zion. This kind of honest personal writing engenders the love and unity that is the very essence of the Zion people. But in order to have that, we can't just be readers, we have to be writers as well. No one ever writes it, no one can ever read it. There's a reason why there isn't a great deal of this kind of writing in our in Mormon literature, and that is because it is so risky. I believe, though, through my own personal experiences, which have proved again and again, that always the benefits, the rewards of writing are commensurate with the risks. The riskier your topic is, the greater potential there is for goodness to come through the act of writing it, both for yourself and for other people. So I just want to briefly talk about how... every step along the way in the writing process, there are risks and rewards that come. Just briefly touch on a few of them. And I'm hoping that even if you're not one of those who might be considering writing yourself, that listening might help you have a greater appreciation for those who do. I think that until you have been in the author's position, it is very easy to underestimate just what that writer has invested in this piece of writing, which you have the privilege of reading. So hopefully that this will engender some more understanding between readers and writers as well. I was not a personal writer until about 5 or 6 years ago. I wrote lots of papers in college, but I'd never done personal writing until a series of very difficult circumstances converged in my life, and I felt really confused. I didn't know what to make of it. It felt like my whole paradigm of understanding the world had crumbled. All the cliches were true.
as far as, you know, your life crumbling around you. That's how I felt. I was, at the time, reading a novel you might be familiar with called The Giver. It's a young adult novel by Lois Lowry. And there's this conversation at the beginning, this family sitting around the dinner table talking about their day, and there was a little girl in the family, and she was describing a conflict that she had with a little boy on the playground at school. And there was this dialogue in which she was trying to express her feelings, and her parents and her brother were kind of gently guiding her to more appropriate feelings. And as I read the dialogue, I was becoming more and more uncomfortable. Finally, I realized what was bothering me about it so much, and it's that it reminded me almost exactly of a story that I would find in the Friend magazine, where there is conflict, but the messiness of emotion isn't allowed, or at least not for very long. And the person who is struggling is deftly and swiftly led on a path to tidy resolution. And we've talked a lot about that already today, so I don't want to belabor that point. But it was a watershed moment for me, where I realized that I didn't know what to do with my complex feelings. I didn't have any models for dealing with them. And that's when I began writing. William Faulkner is famous for a quote in which he said, "The only thing worth writing about is the human heart in conflicts with itself." And I found that this poses an interesting challenge for a Mormon writer, because we're not a people who are comfortable with conflict, not internal conflict. And I found that the paradigms of literature that I was used to have space for what my own personal experience was presenting me. I was gratified and relieved to read in an issue of Exponent 2, a quote. It was an issue about grief, and there was a quote that I'll never forget. It was in a sidebar, and the author said, "There is this myth that if you are a faithful Mormon, you can avoid feeling intense grief." And I will never forget the moment when I read that and realized that that was the conundrum that I was feeling within myself. I had a lot of confused, dark, negative feelings, and thought that they were indicative of weakness on my part. This struggle blossomed when I had my seventh child born 10 weeks early. He was diagnosed with Down syndrome at birth, and I had an emotional reaction that was very complex. I found that the hardest part about it wasn't so much the feelings that I had, but my feelings about my feelings. It wasn't so much that I felt sad, but that I felt guilty for being sad. It wasn't feeling angry was hard, but feeling shame that I was angry was worse. And I realized that I was my worst enemy. I was rejecting myself for feeling what I felt. And that was the biggest impediment to my process of acceptance and progression and moving forward with this upheaval in my life. I have a daughter who was 8 years old at the time that she wrote a short piece about how she felt the day that she was at school and her children talking in a derogatory way about the disabled. And she wrote this essay, which she shared with me, in which she talked about how she wanted to bodily maim this boy who was saying these things. And when I read it, and I published it on the Segula blog, because I was so proud of it, and it caused a stir, and people were understandably concerned about a little girl talking about wanting to kill a classmate. And I understand there are issues there. You know, such emotion, a child who's feeling something that strong does need guidance and needs someone to talk to and needs to be able to find a solid place for that kind of emotion within herself. But I was so relieved because this is my child who, like myself, suffers from significant clinical depression. Her onset was much earlier, much more severe than mine, and so I have a great deal of concern for her. Knowing that she could express such darkness within herself gave me hope that she would not succumb to the depression that grips her. And I truly believe that one of the reasons why mental health issues can be such a burden among the Latter-day Saints is because we have no outlet for our shadow selves. We have no way to process the complexities within us. I wrote a book about my experience with Thomas, that's my little boy with Down syndrome, the first year of my life with him. And I found that in the writing, the most striking concept that I was grappling with again and again was the presence of duality within myself. That there was this child that I loved more than I could ever put words to, and also wished would die at the same time. I wept at the thought of him ever leaving me, and I wept at the thought of him never leaving. And these were feelings that I had no precedent for processing. I knew about opposition from the Book of Mormon. There must be opposition in all things, and I thought that that meant sometimes you're happy and sometimes you're sad. Sometimes good things happen and sometimes bad things happen. My understanding of that has changed quite a bit. I believe that the concept refers to the fact that we can be and will be happy and sad at the very same time, and that we embody mutually exclusive realities which seem like they can't coexist in the same space at the same time, but they do. And until we acknowledge that as a culture, we will have a lot of people feeling ashamed of themselves because they don't understand how such contradictions can exist in them simultaneously. This reality of wanting my son to never leave me, but also leave me as soon as possible, is a very unsettling idea. It's a very unsettling thing to feel and to read about. I had one reader post in a review of my book that she wished she had never read the book because that was such a difficult and painful thing to have to read about. And I truly felt bad. It made me realize that this kind of writing, this kind of stark, blunt writing, isn't necessarily for everybody at all times. And the epigraph at the beginning of my memoir, which is a part of one of the poems that Tracy read, it's a Khalil Gibran quote, and it says, "Your pain is the breaking of your shell, which encloses your understanding." As fervently as I believe in that, I also believe that we are not the ones to pull off the shells of others, only our own, and that those who are not ready to be unshelled should not be forced. It is still difficult, though, and this is one of the risks that writers come across, is the resistant reader, the defensive reader. I had this funny experience that I don't think I have time to share with you, maybe just very, very briefly. Basically, I came across a review of my book on this woman's blog, and she was really upset by part of the stance that I took in my storytelling. And I actually have a quote here. She said, "I was particularly put off by the author's thoughts concerning religious stereotypes and the misguided feelings she had toward the members of her congregation during the first year of her son's life. I am also a member of the same church as the author, and it really should be stated that the views she shared as norms and expectations in the Mormon church are not universal, but are largely affected by her personal views. I have never felt the same pressures to display perfection, buck up, and put on a brave front that she seems to communicate is present in the Mormon faith in general." And now, you got to understand, I don't believe that authors should be policing the internet and striking with an iron fist readers who post unflattering reviews of their work. And this woman had every right to feel however she felt about my book and write whatever she wanted to. But what bugged me, what could not leave me alone, was that her comment she was doing the very same things that she was accusing me of doing. And she was faulting my imperfection all the while that she was claiming she's never felt pressure to be perfect and that Mormons don't pressure each other to be perfect, and yet that's what she was doing. And she was talking about how we don't tell each other to buck up. But that's what she was telling me. And so I left a comment under a pseudonym. And we had a little exchange. I was very, you know, reserved, and just said, it seems to me like you might be approaching the author with the same views that you're accusing her of. You know, you're basically doing the same things you're criticizing her for. And, oh, no, no, no. And we had this exchange for a few comments until she got flustered enough and took the post down. And so I felt really badly, and I emailed her and confessed that I had been the one posting the comments. And she wrote me back a very gracious reply in which she still staunchly defended her point of view and claimed that I was in the wrong for pointing this out, this facet of Mormon culture, even as she displayed it herself. This taught me, though, of the importance in charity, not just for the people whose experiences resonate with ours, but for those who are not ready, who are not open, who are not willing to share that experience. I've edited 4 anthologies of personal writings of others, 2 about family relationships and other relationships of friendship and trust with individuals with Down syndrome, and then 2 about the complexities of motherhood. And in each of these experiences working with these authors, I have seen the benefits that come to the writer, that I've seen how whether or not they receive the kudos and the gratification of having empathetic readers, they themselves benefit through the process of writing. They find truth that otherwise was not accessible to them. They also find the triumph that comes from taking the pain in your life and shaping it to your own ends in a work of literature, a work of art. There's a quote that I'd like to share with you almost to the end here. In all great works of literature, regardless of the grim reality they present, there is an affirmation of life against the transience of that life, an essential defiance. This affirmation lies in the way the author takes control of reality by retelling it in her own way, thus creating a new world. Every great work of art, I would declare pompously, is a celebration, an act of insubordination against the betrayals, horrors, and infidelities of life. The perfection and beauty of form rebels against the ugliness and shabbiness of the subject matter. You might recognize that quote from Azar Nafisi from reading Lolita in Tehran, her memoir. This is something that I've seen people experience again and again and have experienced myself. There is a triumph that comes over personal circumstances simply through the act of writing about them. This is also part of the divine pattern of creation, where you take raw material and you shape it into a form that serves a purpose. This is a way of finding personal redemption and overcoming the injustices and horrors of our personal lives. The ultimate reward, though, of writing is the communion that we find with others. So many examples I could share that I don't have time for. I just want to state that I have experienced again and again the sacred space that is created when both writer and reader are open to the experience of the other. There is a communion there that I believe is the essence of the redemption from the fall. The curse of mortality, after all, is separation from our own selves, from others, and from God. And when we have these moments of communion, this is the very antithesis of the fall. This is what brings about the essence of Zion. This is what heals the wounds of mortality and enables us to connect with the divinity that is within us and around us. Just in closing, I'd like to share a poem with you that I hope will inspire you either to share your own stories or to be more open to the stories of others. It's called Kindness. from the poet Naomi Shihab Nye. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore, only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread, only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, it is I you have been looking for, and then goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend. Thank you.
So what have I learned? I've learned that for me, in my patience, I keep my soul. I have learned to keep commandments because it pleases God with no other expectation. I have learned that Jesus Christ is the only begotten Son of God. I have learned that nothing can separate me from the love of God that is in Jesus Christ. So how in my story did I learn these things again? I've got to admit, I started blogging in order to avoid talking in public, so that people would read and not bother me, so I wouldn't have to face people. And here I am. So my story. About Christmas, our six-year-old came down with the flu. Her last night at home, I sat and held her all night so she could sleep. Then she was admitted to the hospital, spent 60 days in various ICUs, and died on January 6th, my wedding anniversary. It helps ensure I never forget it. 11 months later, just before she turned 2, our youngest child died on December 26th. Again, we were left with unopened Christmas presents, neighbors who took down the decorations, and a home teacher who avoided us. But we remained engaged in the community. My wife, Wynn, went back to school for a second degree and graduated as co-valedictorian. I rebuilt my legal practice. Clients will abandon you when you go through a tragedy, and they'll think they're doing you a favor. Then I was approached by a group to run for elective office against an incumbent they were desperate to beat. They were willing to spend $1 million. And I found out about it because it was the front page of the newspaper before they talked to me. They invited me to breakfast, but they're kind of do damage control. The current office holder got wind of it, and on reflection decided to announce his retirement. My wife, Wynn, spoke at the BYU's Women's Conference. She was 7 months pregnant, and I promised myself that when that daughter was born, when Robin was born, with this child we would heal. I'd also continued to publish, and known to me, there were groups looking at me, and in a couple years, I was going to start getting invitations to interview for tenure-track positions. Sounds like a triumphant, happy ending, doesn't it? So Robin was born. My dad beat the cancer we thought was going to kill him in 6 months. But Robin had a heart defect. She survived the surgery when 40% of the children died. She reached a safe place and took her home. Then she developed a hidden arrhythmia. If you know my family, you know the rest of the story. When he came home from work to see me on guts, they took over from me. But CPR failed. 4.5 years, 3 graveside services. And here I am. I have 2 children I adore, and a wife who is my life. My youngest has Tourette's and needs a lot of time. I've had to cancel things I was deeply involved in. So while I won an over 35 AAU state championship a year ago, I'm no longer involved in the sport because my daughter needs me. Instead of a 30-something guy who's in windsurfing focus groups, building a reputation in a breaking area, I'm in my mid-50s with an interest in a rock-cooled academic area where I don't have a reputation at all. But I've learned lessons because, much to my surprise, God sustained me and the Spirit was with me. I've learned that in life or death, that Jesus is the Christ. That life is in Christ and not in other things. That virtue is its own reward, because virtue itself is the true goal, not a payoff in other things of the world. That's my story. We've got a little bit of time left, and I invite you to ask questions of our panel or to tell us your own stories. Thank you.
Just adored every single thing every one of you said, and I thank you all so much. As a lifetime feminist, I see my younger self sitting up there. My question is this: how do you feel your efforts are impacting, I hate that word, but the church as a whole?
Anyone or all?
Oh, yeah. You can't shut me up.
Personally, I do think that the blogging affects the church as a whole, as we affect the individuals. And I know in my ward, I see, in my ward, in my life, in my friendships, I see, wow, where's Fanny? Who would have thought? Yeah, I feel it. I see it. And I think that... I ask myself on a regular basis, what do people do before the internet? On so many levels, but on this especially, I mean, there are so many times where, you know, we are suffering, but we can't bring ourselves to let somebody see us unshowered with mascara dripping down our face and with the filthy house. And, like, in that moment when we need help the most, we can't bring ourselves to allow someone to see us that moment. But we can, you know, reach out our trembling little fingers through the ether of the internet. And that makes a difference for all of us living through it, but it makes a difference for the people hearing it, too, because one act begets another. And I really testify, you know, of that creation of Zion that creates. Yes, please.
Well, I think it's hard to testify to causality, necessarily. You don't know what is... doing what as far as the institutional church is concerned, but I spoke to the slight changes I've seen in the Enzyme's little blurb section of inspirational stories. And I don't remember 10 years ago seeing any stories back there that weren't tied at the end in a bow where you prayed for the pony, got the pony. And I have noticed ones that weren't just a straight formulaic five paragraph thing a lot more recently. And I've actually heard a few people comment on how strange they were. And I thought, well, I found it quite refreshing. But I don't know why, necessarily, they're there. Perhaps it's because I spoke to the editor of The Enzyme a few years ago. I just ran into him through a mutual friend. We wound up talking about infertility. And I thanked him for the number of, at that point, they recently published a few articles about infertility, and he has a number of children. I don't know if it's the same editor now, actually, but he said, he blushed. He said, well, we try to pay attention. We do actually look at what's being said out there on the internet. So who knows? That's one small change I've seen. I do agree with what Jesus said about at least the body communal of the church. You know, we do reach each other as a body. I think the more honest we are on the internet, hopefully the braver that makes us when we go to church. It makes me braver. It can. I mean, there's a possibility that we'll just blow off our steam on the internet and then we'll hide. That's a temptation. I hope we don't give in to that temptation. I was... the ward before, the one I'm currently in, my second week there, I was asked to give a presentation on being a sexual assault survivor, and I thought, oh, great, I'm going to be defined immediately. And I thought, who cares? If they want to choose to sum me up that way, that's just silly. And so I spoke on what I spoke about, and people came up afterwards crying and confessing, and I think that was good.
We want to hear from more of you.
I've got a question. I don't remember your name. Second from the end.
Janet.
My sister recently, within the last couple of years, had a similar situation to where she was raped as an adult. And unfortunately, her attacker was let go. He was acquitted because of lack of evidence. I'm just—it's hard for me to accept that, you know, God not only allows, you know, innocent, well, not completely innocent people, but people like my sister to get raped, and then for them to, you know, be let go through the justice system. I'm just curious what your experience with that was, with the justice system, if he's like, if he, you know, went to jail, or if he had to deal with all of that, if he ever felt like there was closure at all.
That's a large question. You know, the problem of evil in the universe is a large question. Mormons have a slight escape hatch in that we don't believe God created evil. But on a personal level, apparently this isn't working very well. Neither the person who molested me when I was a child, nor the two people who sexually assaulted me when I was an adult, to my knowledge, have ever served time. When I was one of the people who assaulted me when I was an adult, BYU was very aware of their identity. Multiple girls came forward, but there was not enough evidence. I didn't come forward soon enough, despite having been the president of the feminist club at the time and being very good at counseling other women. I internalized plenty of cultural messages, and I didn't come to the police soon enough. So when I did speak to the police, who were very, very kind to me, fatherly even, you could see one of them restraining himself from rushing out and wanting to just beat the crap out of the guy. It was really clear that they would not get a conviction, so it never went to trial. The individual has used, he was, geez, these things get recorded. he was kicked out of BYU. I believe he was the first person kicked out of BYU for sexual assault. And he uses the fact that he was kicked out of BYU as leverage for coolness in his current life, I've been told. So, yeah, that's a difficult bit of an equation. But for me, you know, that's his life. Those are his choices. And at some point, it's not so much that I decided to let go as God allows for free will, and I'm okay with that. I don't want a world where God jerry-rigs everything. I don't want God to be forcing me to make decisions. And if you want to speak with me after the session, I'd extremely glad to, because this is a very large question. But no, my personal experience wasn't one that tied up nicely with the bow in the justice system. It was incredibly complicated and drawn out for months. And while I had a lot of very good people on my side, it still didn't work out well. But I've come to a place where I'm very much at peace about it. I had moments of anger about what happened, but for the most part, theologically, I'm at peace and very, very comforted that this is not a person who can hurt me, and that the amount of goodness in the world far, far outweighs the amount of badness. But please, please, I'm very happy to talk to you afterwards about this if you want to.
We're so out of time, but I wanted to speak to that very briefly and say that I, too, have a history of sexual assault, and mine never even made it to the courts. I have no closure in this life. But for my own healing, I found tremendous balm in the atonement, using it as a victim, trusting that there is eternal justice, whatever justice I might not experience in this life, I have confidence will exist in the next. And also reading in the Book of Mormon about Alma and Amulek, and when their followers were being burned, Amulek says to Alma, "Why, you have the power of God, why can't we stop this?" And Alma says, "We have to allow this to happen to prove the wickedness of their hearts so their judgment can be fair."
And Romans 8 is really good too.
After reading about Alma and Amulek, I found intense significance in the sacredness of being a victim. This might sound a little ridiculous. It's very sacred to me, and I have not been able to put it in words appropriately, but I do feel like there can be almost a calling to it. Not that it's something we should sign up for or be doormats or aspire to, exactly. But I do feel like when we allow the atonement to take that from us, we become partners in Christ, with Christ, in bearing that burden, in bearing the burden of the sin that someone had. It has to go somewhere in this life for them to be properly judged. And by us being the vessel asked to bear that sin, we become saviors with a lowercase s, and united to Christ in a way that I find very, very sacred.
And in that place, you move from being a victim to being a survivor, and that is really essential. You want to move from, you don't have to say victim, you move to being a survivor.
Okay, I think we are